wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and streaming at kboo.fm. You just heard the beautiful voice of Clayton Morgridge, one of our old moles, singing the introduction, the intro theme. This is Lori Mercier, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning, the collective of agitator moles provide interviews, reviews, and views from an underground perspective, which we hope lead to greater understanding, reflection, and action. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer today. The old mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. The mole goes where corporate media fear to tread, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority and giving voice to movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society. As always, you can subscribe to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KBOO website, and you can also find there links to past shows and segments with further links to even more useful information, including how to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And you can contact us through that page or at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Today we're addressing community power. We often feel powerless in the face of the military corporate juggernaut that has rigged our local, regional, and national political systems. We're focusing today on the kind of community activism that uses the tools of the powerful, in particular the electoral and legal systems, to make radical change. First, Bill Resnick speaks with Madeline Carroll and Maria Cahill of Oregon District Attorneys for the People, who are part of a national movement to elect progressive DAs who, instead of targeting Black, brown, homeless, and immigrant communities, will instead hold police and prosecutors accountable in protecting everyone in our communities. The district attorney is the most powerful position in the criminal legal system, and the campaign aims to decrease the everyday impact that the criminal legal system has on communities of color, while building community power to self-determine what safety and healing look like. Then Hector Dominguez, Open Data Coordinator for Smart City PDX, joins me in the studio to discuss how to build community input in crafting facial recognition and surveillance technologies policies. Many of you are aware of how these technologies are quickly creeping into every aspect of our lives, and we'll talk about how to rein in their spread in Portland. Finally, Jan Hocken interviews Alice Cherry, staff attorney at the Climate Defense Project in Berkeley, about legal tactics, civil disobedience, and the climate movement, several upcoming trials of activists using the necessity defense, and the recent ruling in Giuliana versus the United States. Now, here is the Mole's Bill Resnick with Maria Cahill and Madeline Carroll.
Hi, Madeline Carroll and Marie Cahill. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
Maria and Madeline are organizers of the recently formed group Oregon District Attorney for the People, joining a national movement that's challenging how prosecutors, the district attorneys, prosecute crimes. They're quite powerful in every city in the country, everywhere in the country, in fact. They're actually the key people in the criminal justice system, which is not a criminal. The justice part is it's a system and it's criminal, but it's not, it has very little to do with justice.
True.
Hey, that was a good line.
Yeah. It's true.
Very true.
We call it the injustice system.
We say criminal legal system when we're being nice.
Oh, yes. Oh, good.
Yeah.
Anyway, you've developed a sort of outlandish idea that district attorneys, they should who put a lot of people in jail and every now and then even have a trial. So why are you seeking to have the prosecutors operate for the people, for the public welfare, rather than for their own needs to get reelected by promoting themselves as protecting us and our saviors from all of those horrible criminals out there that they're putting away? Why are you challenging them?
Well, This is Maria Cahill. I'm a volunteer organizer with Pacific Northwest Family Circle, and I work with families who have lost loved ones to police violence. Our organization is led by those families, and they have a very different experience of the district attorney. When police killed their loved ones, they were consistently not told the truth, not given information in a timely fashion. And in every single one of the cases of loved ones killed by police in our organization and across the state in the last 27 years, 360 loved ones killed by police, in all cases, there are no consequences for police officers. So our families have a very different lived experience of the district attorney than what the public commonly thinks of as their role to, as you say, Bill, put away all those terrible criminals.
We are targeting district attorneys because they are the most powerful locally elected official, and they tend to really fly under the radar too. A lot of people don't know the powers that they have, and that's really by design. Maria helped us to understand the analysis coming from the families and from a larger organization that they are chapter of, which is POST, Protect Our Stolen Treasures, which is out of Detroit and is headed by Yolanda McNair. And the analysis that POST and the families have done is that there are people in the system that can hold police accountable for violence. Most of those people are not interested in doing that. And we have very little influence over those people. So that includes police chiefs, police unions. But in the case of the district attorney, while most current and historic district attorneys have not been interested in holding police accountable, as Maria was saying, in Oregon, not a single district attorney has chosen to prosecute a police officer who has killed a community member. We do elect them, and so we do have some influence over that role in the criminal legal system. And because of that, we can change the conversation about what the role of the district attorney should be in the system, and we can target that role in the system in order to create change. So one of the powers of the district attorney is that they have the power to hold police accountable, but it turns out that they have an incredible or even an obscene amount of power over a lot of people's lives, especially now that we are in a period of time when an unprecedented number of people are being incarcerated and things like houselessness and poverty are being criminalized, as well as immigration now is, well, and historically has been, but it's sort of at a peak at the moment of the level of criminalization that is being added to immigration. So district attorneys can hold police accountable. That was kind of our entry point into this work with the analysis of the families.
They can also hold the rest of the system accountable.
Yes.
They have tremendous influence over corrections. If they think that the people are going into these correctional facilities are and that maybe should be there but are being treated badly, they can in fact also take action against that.
Exactly.
They are crucial. In fact, they can make and break mayors by their decisions in terms
yes.
of people are afraid of the prosecutors.
What we learned in our process is they have power over the judges. Right. So one of the district attorney candidates that we interviewed in Multnomah County told us that while they were working for the district attorney, they were told to just go to the judge and tell the judge we want 5 years for this person. And the judge said, well, what is that going to do? This is like this person has been in front of us over and over and over again. You're going to incarcerate them again. How does that really solve the problem? And this person went back to their DA, asked them that question. The judge asked me this, and DA Rod Underhill said, tell the judge we're giving them 5 years.
Yes, the reason they can go after judges is all they have to do is hint to the papers that this judge is soft on crime, the judges are elected, and these judges are afraid of them. And the police union has an enormous power, and it has a lot of people in it who are very aggressive and have families and neighbors, And so they have this huge voting block, and it's a solid block for hardline policies, and that the DAs are the people who, in fact, manage that political operation.
It's true.
Yep.
District attorneys have an incredible amount of power over setting the culture and the policies. They set the culture and the policies for the prosecutors who are their employees, and those policies can include what they will and will not prosecute. So, for example, if a district attorney says, I am not going to prosecute any low-level drug offenses, so even if police arrest people for low-level drug offenses and bring them in, then I'm going to decline to prosecute them and they will be released. That really affects the culture of the police, because if you are bringing people in for things that are technically an arrestable offense, but they're not going to be prosecuted, then that's really ineffective police work. So district attorneys can affect greatly both the ethics of the police themselves and also the prosecutors that are their employees, because they are the ones holding those prosecutors accountable. There's really no other accountability in the system aside from their boss.
And to be clear, the district attorney has the power to choose what they do and do not prosecute.
Yes.
Which I think a lot of people don't realize.
And that's a big part of our platform.
So we're not asking them to do something that's against the law. We're asking them to do something that's within their power to make the community safer.
Right. In fact, I wanted to get to that. What they can do, in fact, is not just release people, but in fact offer to higher level drug users, not just the occasional kid who gets caught with a joint somewhere. Then they come down hard in some jurisdictions, not all now, right in this country. Mm-hmm. But they can, in fact, divert people. It's right. Diversion is this big word that's not done very often by the DAs. But they can divert people to helping programs. And they, in fact, have the power, it seems to me, within the whole system, to begin doing less police work and hiring more people if they came out for, we really shouldn't be arresting and putting into the criminal justice system these people. We should be offering them the services that they want. Most of the people who have bad drug problems wind up wanting to have treatment and not getting it. So criminal.
Yeah.
They're arrested for what they would love to have a treatment program for, and they're all filled up.
Yeah, and in the case of our platform, that's true for people with mental health conditions. They need care that they are not receiving. People who are houseless, many people who are houseless would like to be housed. In the case of sex work, our platform there is really focused on consensual sex work. And so I'm not going to say that sex workers in that context need a program, but there may be some sex workers out there who would like to have an alternative. And it's kind of similar to what we were talking about, Bill, earlier in the program, about how why people go into policing, right? There just aren't that many great jobs where you can get paid decently and not have a college education. And we need more of those for everybody.
Yeah, the DAs, in fact, it seems to me, could be, and there may be some DAs in the country, in some cities like Philadelphia. I think Chicago has a new DA, Baltimore. Some of them have been disappointing. Once they get into office, they forget their...
Yes, you're touching on a lot of the strategy of our campaign. So Oregon DA for Their People is highly influenced and inspired by other campaigns that are happening across the country in a nationwide movement to change the conversation about what the role of the district attorney should be as opposed to what it has historically has been. We have been in contact with several of those campaigns, including Philly DA for the People. So the strategy really involved in this movement is to locally create platforms about what you, the people, want district attorneys to do, what you want their role to be in your community, and then to use that platform to have a community conversation about how the role can change. And then in the process of election cycles, use that platform to encourage people who agree with those points in the platform to run for office. One of the big issues with the district attorney system is that most district attorneys in Oregon in the last 10 years, it's been almost 80% of district attorneys have run unopposed. And we believe that it's important for people to have a choice. And the first step in having a choice is having more than one person running for these offices. So in Multnomah County, the platform that we put together helped flesh out so far three candidates. There's still time. People have until March to announce a candidacy for this race. And we definitely encourage folks who are out there who are still considering a run to keep considering that strongly. We don't think that the three candidates that we have now have to be the only three candidates. But we do have three candidates, and that is a step that we have more than one person that's running. Also, having multiple candidates encourages people to learn about the role of the DA, because if they have choices, they want to know what that office does and what factors should go into helping them make that choice.
Let's go into how you would elevate the position or generate much more public knowledge of the importance of the DA, and that the DA is elected, and this is as important a vote as it is to vote for as the mayoralty vote or whatever, the city council.
Frankly, I think it's things happen at the local level. It's more important than voting for the president.
Well, this time around, I'm not sure.
I'm just going to put it out there.
But at the local level, yes, there's no question. The president always has a hand on the button, you know, the red button.
But at the local level, things happen on the local level, and this is the most powerful person in our county.
And everybody at the local level actually has effects on the national level. At the local level, a city that works and has a very different criminal justice system would influence all the others. There's nothing better than a good example, and a lot of them, that you can be safer by, in fact, treating people with dignity and trying to help even people who did some antisocial things frequently, that you can help people find different ways of life. It really is possible to do it, especially if there are, of course, good jobs for people and they can lead a dignified life and not just scramble to stay alive and to try and support their kids and fail. You know, that we've put people in distressing positions in this society.
Absolutely. As far as having strong influence over people's lives and really having the power to change people's lives, I would say that district attorneys have the most power over the most people in a county. So just for folks who don't know, and definitely no shame around not knowing, because as I said earlier, this system flies under the radar on purpose. So in Oregon, a district, as in a district attorney, is a county. So we have 36 counties and we have 36 district attorneys in Oregon, and they serve 4-year terms, and not all of them run at the same time. So every year there are different counties who are electing new district attorneys. So this year our campaign is focusing on Multnomah and Clackamas counties, because the founding members of Pacific Northwest Family Circle, their family members were killed in those two counties, and so it's our starting point. But we're looking to grow this campaign over time, so we're very interested in hearing from people in other counties who are interested in adapting the platform that we've created to fit their communities and grow this campaign into the future. Unlike a lot of campaigns that happen during the electoral cycle, we are not endorsing a candidate or any candidates. The goal is not to elect some magical single person who's going to transform the system on their own. It's about community-led change, and that includes, regardless of who gets elected, holding them accountable to the degree that you can during their time in office, and then continuing to push for more change when a new person can be elected.
These DAs get huge amount of exposure for their crime fighting. They can do the perp walks. They can go on TV and announce their decisions to indict this horrible criminal. They probably have more TV time than any other public official, actually, when if you think about it. You got a big job in exposing and challenging that whole idea and getting people to understand how they work. So I wish you the best. Oh, no, we have to tell people how to contact you.
So the Oregon DA for the People platform, which you can find at OregonDAForThePeople.com, includes six areas of reform. Those are stop targeting Black, Brown, Indigenous, and immigrant communities, end mass incarceration, decline to prosecute individuals with mental health conditions, treat kids like kids, hold police and prosecutors accountable, and decriminalize houselessness, sex work, and drug use.
Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Yeah,
and we really appreciate having this opportunity.
Yeah, we'll do it again.
Thank you, Bill Resnick, who was feeling a bit under the weather, and we wish him a speedy recovery. And Madeline Carroll and Maria Cahill, organizers of the important new group, Oregon District Attorneys for the People. I'll say more about that group and how you can find out about them at the end of the show. And you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. This is Lori Mercier, and we want to welcome Hector Dominguez, who is the Open Data Coordinator for Smart City PDX, a group that is working collaboratively with the community, private and public sector partners, and the City of Portland staff to use data and technology responsibly. Hector comes from a mixed background of entrepreneurship, research, and nonprofit organizations with expertise on Internet of Things, advanced analytics, robotics and automation, and artificial intelligence. He has a PhD in mechanical engineering with a focus on manufacturing solar concentrators and sustainable manufacturing. Welcome to KBOO, Hector Dominguez.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about what Smart City PDX is and what it's up to.
Smart City PDX is a program that is part of the City of Portland. We are hosted at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And that's the way in which the city is trying to work around emerging technology, data, and information. Right now, all these different disruptive technologies like artificial intelligence, big data, Internet of Things, are changing the way that we are actually living in cities, living in towns, how we do our lives in general. So smart cities is really a way that we are trying to do the work that cities need to be doing of providing better services for our residents.
Well, in terms of better services, I know that facial recognition and surveillance technologies are spreading everywhere, and they're spreading so rapidly people haven't been able to really mount sufficient regulations and publicly air their concerns about this kind of technology that's invading our everyday lives. It's present in our private as well as public lives. And the Washington County Sheriff's Office recently purchased from Amazon a powerful facial recognition program which allows police to identify suspects from surveillance footage or photographs. And this prompted Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty to spearhead discussion of a ban. And this is something that a lot of communities and cities across the country are preparing to do to try to limit, or not just limit, but actually ban this technology. So Hardesty noted that we need to take a strong stance that this automated surveillance state is not welcome in Portland. So what is Smart City doing in terms of working with the community to talk about what to do with this technology.
Yeah, I want to highlight that all these issues around information privacy, surveillance technologies, we see those as human rights issues. So Smart City PDX has started that work since 2018 in collaboration with our Office of Equity and Human Rights from the very beginning. So back in 2018, we were working on some privacy principles for the city of Portland and looking into what was out there in the world. We saw what the European Union had done with the General Data Protection Regulation. They had created a whole framework around privacy rights for European citizens. We were looking at what other cities here in the U.S. have done, particularly our sister cities of Seattle, Oakland, San Francisco, where they also have some principles. And then we start from there, trying to figure out what was the best fit for Portland, and then considering all this new technology. And then we developed a set of principles, seven principles, basically in providing two main innovations. One is around automated decision systems. For instance, we need to understand what's behind any algorithm, what's behind how we store data and information, who's having access to all that. And the second innovation there was data utility. We call it data utility. That means the city, as local government, we are going only to capture only the minimum amount of personal identifiable information, and that has to have a very defined purpose that brings utility to the city and to the communities as well. So that was in 2018. Those principles passed last year in June, so it took a really long time, because we really needed to have this cultural change in the city. So think about first privacy, information protection, and then let's do the data collection and so on. And then the natural way to go was, now we need to see how we are going to implement those principles and what's out there that we really need to look at. And then we identified facial recognition as one of those hot topics that really could bring the community together to start those conversations. The long run is really how we are going to manage surveillance technology in a time where the information is all over. You can imagine like this new generation of babies where parents are actually posting everything about them even before they are born. And they're born. And then that creates really a whole history that somebody is actually going to mine. Somebody is going to find all these social patterns, and then somebody is going to use those. And the problem is, who has control on that? How that's going to be used or even abused? Do we have any safety barriers around that? So that's really the whole conversation. Facial recognition comes in because it already has some political momentum, and we need to react to that and do something. And we are very grateful that Commissioner Hardesty's office is being the leaders in really these conversations. We are supporting that work from the technical aspects, creating those connections with our community. However, this is a really longer conversation that has to do with how the city and government uses information and how much control also as an individuals we have over that.
Well, right. So facial recognition is just the tip of the iceberg, and perhaps it's more widely known because of just how frightening it is to people that they're being monitored all over the place, that you can't just take a walk in the park and, you know, think about anything because you're actually under surveillance in any public space.
Absolutely. I mean, you can imagine. So what is facial recognition? That's the first question that probably we need to answer. Facial recognition is really a process where through video or any other footage, an algorithm is actually collecting biometric data from your face and then using that biometric data for any purpose. Like, you can use that to unlock your phone, to have access to any facility, for instance, or also you can use that data to identify potential people of interest and quotation, right? Where that, so who defines who people of interest are? That's one issue, right?
And we know who those people of interest are. They tend to be dissidents, people of color, more vulnerable communities. And there's also this eerie resemblance to the long history of racial classification and using kind of physical types to categorize people. And so this facial recognition technology certainly sort of parallels that long history of racial typecasting and making assumptions about who is involved in criminal behavior and which group should be targeted. So that technology has also proven to be very inaccurate. Studies that have been done about this technology and how it's linked to other data have resulted in a lot of false positives and
I mean, also we need to understand that this is quite complex. It's not only one technology. There are hundreds of algorithms out there. Some of them are actually really good for some specific applications, you know? And you think about your phone, how you unlock your phone, and those are like pretty good. And some companies provide like a really good and robust service in general. So there are, we believe there are legitimate uses of the technology. However, the question is still out there. Who has control on that? And if a company, any third party is using your personal and sensitive information, how much do you have control on that process, you know? That's the big question. And the technology, any technology is going to keep evolving, and eventually it's going to get there. It's going to get into a place where really good biases are going to be really... We're going to be over that. But then, as you mentioned, this is just the tip of the iceberg, right? It's like a whole pipeline of collecting biometric data, storing biometric data, having third parties using that information for any purpose, and then destroying or being able to destroy that data as well, which is coming from you and is defining who you are. You
know? So how do we as a community, as a city, react then to controlling who has access to that data? I mean, what kinds of safeguards can be enacted? What kinds of protections to ensure our privacy as citizens?
We are encouraging conversations. One, like, know what we are talking about, for instance. As I mentioned, this is quite complex, but learn about the technology, go together with groups that are actually, here in Portland, we are really blessed with a number of groups that they are really on top of privacy issues, for instance, and go and get close to them. And then start learning about what digital rights are, for instance, because digital rights is about privacy, is about having access to internet and communications, is to have access to those technology literacy. So it's that big picture. And we are trying to create those spaces as well. Before we run out of time, I would love one of those spaces that we are trying to create is to bring some of those groups closer to our elected leaders and decision makers. So there is a more informed decision on what we need to do in the city. So tomorrow, January 28th, we are having a work session on facial recognition at City Council. It starts at 9:30 and it goes 2 hours long. And we are having a number of community-based organizations. Urban League is going to be there. BIRD, the Coalition of Immigrant Rights, the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition, Freedom to Thrive, and then some local, the Portland Business Associations, Technology Association of Oregon, and the ACLU Oregon are going to be presenting there. Also with our Portland Police, who's been asked to provide how the City of Portland Police is actually using or planning to use facial recognition. So it's going to be a quite rich conversation, and we invite everybody to listen to.
So it's important for people to become involved and to be part of that conversation. I mean, you mentioned a number of digital rights groups that are active in the Portland area. I'm assuming the Portland Immigration Rights Association, I know ACLU of Oregon.
ACLU.
Are there other groups that people might be able to contact to get involved?
PDX Privacy is one of those groups that I think they are doing a lot of outreach. You know, there is a separation sometimes between who is doing technology and who's doing more advocacy work. And we understand that groups that do advocacy group, they're already stressed with really tough issues. And then on top of that, we are asking them to start looking into like artificial intelligence, big data, and it's quite like a lot of work. So we encourage collaboration and then building this trusted networks around in town.
Well, we'll remind at the end of the show, we'll remind folks about that work session tomorrow. But it is important for us because I think people become intimidated by technology. Mm-hmm. This is complicated, can't understand it with the limited time I have. But it is important to know how this data is being collected and analyzed. And is smart cities involved in actual collection or analysis of data?
Smart Cities is, relatively speaking, a small program, but we work with everyone in the city. So our team is really three coordinating people, but within that coordination, we are collaborating with every single bureau in the city, and we keep very close together to our Office of Equity and Human Rights as well. So what we do is really provide support around policy making, around, right now we're starting providing some privacy impact assessments, for instance, to different bureaus when somebody wants to evaluate a new project or a new product, particularly on emerging technology. So we encourage them to come to us. And as a matter of fact, after our privacy principles passed at City Council in June last year, so we started a privacy internal privacy work group with the task to develop a proposal to City Council around how privacy needs to be implemented in the city, whether or not we need a chief privacy officer, or we need something like the City of Oakland, where they have a privacy advisory commission, where that commission is volunteers from the community who have the right expertise around privacy, and they are doing assessments around surveillance technologies, for instance. Or perhaps we are doing something mixed, you know?
Well, thank you so much, Hector Dominguez, for coming in today and talking about this important issue about surveillance and collection of data that's all around us and how we in Portland can initiate important discussions about how to protect our privacy. And coming up next, Jan Hocken will be here with Alice Cherry in this month's Left in the Law segment. Cherry is staff attorney at the Climate Defense Project in Berkeley, and she and Jan discuss legal tactics, civil disobedience in the climate movement, including several upcoming trials of activists using the necessity defense and the recent ruling in Juliana versus the United States, the civil case filed by youth suing the government for depriving them of a livable future. So right now we're going to hear some music from Jill Scott and then Jan Hocken and Alice Cherry.
This is Jan Hocken speaking this morning with Alice Cherry, co-founder and staff attorney with the Climate Defense Project in Berkeley. Welcome to KABU, Alice Cherry.
Hi, Jan. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's first talk about the work of the Climate Defense Project. Some is implicit in the title, but what kind of climate defense work do you do?
Yeah, sure. So we work on cases across the country, and so far we've been focused on defending climate activists, so people who are doing civil disobedience, who are doing direct action kind of as a last resort to try to stop fossil fuel projects from being built, often right at home in their own communities. And among these folks and folks in the climate movement more broadly, there's been a lot of interest lately in a particular legal argument that's called the necessity defense. And so that's where a lot of our work at Climate Defense Project has been concentrated. There aren't many other lawyers doing these kinds of cases, and so there's kind of an unmet need for it.
And many here in Oregon are familiar with the Valve Turners, a case that, as Ken Ward, that's being tried on appeal in Mount Vernon in a few weeks, and another case of the Zenith activists protesting Zenith in Portland, who are trying to use a necessity defense at trial later this month. Can you explain the elements of the necessity defense as perhaps both a legal and a political strategy?
Yeah, so it's also known as the choice of evils defense. It's a very old common law doctrine that can be found in the laws of most states and some other countries. And basically, it allows leeway for a person to violate a law when necessary to avert a greater harm. And so the classic example is the baby in a burning building, right, where a person trespasses and breaks into a building in order to save a child in danger. In that kind of situation, the courts recognize an exception to the usual legal rule, and the person committing the trespass wouldn't be held responsible. Generally arguing a necessity defense requires meeting a few criteria, and it's pretty common sense. You have to show that you were attempting to avert a greater harm, so in other words, greater than whatever harm you may have caused through your law breaking. Often you're also required to show that the harm was imminent. You have to demonstrate a causal nexus. In other words, you know, was it reasonable to think that you could actually avert the harm using your chosen method of intervention? And then finally, you have to show that you had no option but to break the law. So there were no other realistic ways of accomplishing the same goal short of breaking the law. So that's the necessity defense. Today it's used in many political protest cases as well. This began with the protests against the Vietnam War and has continued ever since then, which is how climate activists got the idea.
What are the most difficult elements of the defense to argue? I know, and perhaps specifically in the climate movement, but in general, what are the hardest thresholds for juries? And I think it's also important to note that the defendants claim not guilty by reason of moral necessity. There is a long history of civil disobedience where activists claim that yes, I am guilty, I did this, but this is a different, how is this different from other kinds of uses of the court around civil disobedience? And then what are the hardest elements?
Yeah, so that's true. It is technically a legal justification, so it's not necessary to plead guilty. You plead not guilty, as you mentioned. In these cases, the argument is very similar to what I described. You're just mapping it onto a different set of circumstances. So, for instance, when you have activists who are stopping deliveries of coal to a coal plant or turning off the flow of oil through a pipeline, they're arguing that that is a necessary response to the climate emergency at this late hour. And generally in these cases, the first two prongs of the defense that I summarized a minute ago are fairly easy to meet. No one can really dispute that the climate emergency is extremely serious and imminent. But those second two prongs about causation and alternative avenues of affecting change, those are the harder ones for most political protest defendants, including climate activists. And so at these trials where defendants are attempting to get courts to give them permission to put on the defense, they're often relying on research by experts to show that our political and legal systems are currently broken and incapable of fixing the problem, but also that nonviolent civil disobedience has a long history of kind of forcing political progress on problems like the climate emergency, you know, problems that are large scale and seemingly intractable and aren't being solved by the systems we have in place.
And the cases themselves involve enormous commitment and preparation and, of course, counter many of the popular and media representations of activists as kind of rioting in the streets or creating mayhem, putting people at risk. And there is that, but this is a very, very deliberative process, whether to take on the defense and to prepare. And a lot of these cases continue for long periods of time with appeals. What, given all of the investments and commitments over time, what are the political dividends? What are the political gains? And perhaps you could mention a few recent and upcoming cases to talk about it less abstractly and more in terms of what's happening on the ground.
Yeah, sure. I mean, preparing to argue a necessity defense can be a helpful tool for a lot of movements because it does force you to think hard about what you've tried first before resorting to civil disobedience and what your argument is for the effectiveness of what you're doing, you know, among other things. And so it's kind of a useful structure for activists to keep in mind as they're planning an action. I think also just, you know, the one reason that this has been such a high priority for many people in different social movements is that being able to make the case to a jury that what you did was justified by the situation is just so important in these cases. It's really hard to go to trial for something and not be able to say why you did it. And especially when you're talking about, you know, the sort of problems of access to the political system and democracy not functioning very well right now, it's really great for juries to be able to hear these cases and act as the community to decide whether someone should be held responsible. It's a really basic way to participate in a democracy. So in terms of recent and upcoming cases, you know, they're happening all over the country and also around the world. They've been going on here in the U.S. for about the last 10 years or so, and some of the earliest cases were in Utah, Florida, Massachusetts, New York, but fossil fuel infrastructure is kind of all over the country, and so these cases are happening everywhere. Lately, we've seen a lot of cases in the Midwest, including Minnesota and North Dakota, as well as in Washington State. And Jan, you mentioned two trials that are coming up in the Pacific Northwest, Ken Ward's trial in Mount Vernon, Washington, and the Extinction Rebellion case against the Zenith facility in Portland. Ken's case is unusual in that it's the only case so far in which an appeals court has delivered a ruling recognizing the climate necessity defense and giving the defendant kind of advance permission to argue it in court. So it'll be one of the first real tests of the climate necessity defense.
And we had a earlier this month, the ninth disappointing decision, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled 2-1 to dismiss the Giuliano versus U.S. lawsuit, a case familiar to many of us here in Oregon, based in Eugene, involving 21 young people who sued the federal government for violating their right to a safe climate and a livable future. This was a civil case, partly unique by the scope of it and that it was against the federal government versus the fossil fuel companies or banks or states. Can you comment on the significance of that ruling and the difference between the legal strategy of a civil suit versus climate actions that involve the criminal courts?
Yeah, so Giuliano is a civil case in which, as you mentioned, a group of young people are suing the U.S. government. They allege that their constitutional rights are being violated by the government's promotion and subsidization of fossil fuel use, and that the government actually has a legal responsibility to implement a climate action plan that fits what scientists are telling us we need to do. So as you mentioned, the case is in federal court, and for some time now the government has been filing appeals to try to get the case thrown out. And the government has argued that the plaintiffs don't have standing, in other words, they don't have a right to be in court in the first place. And recently what happened is that the Ninth Circuit, which is a federal court of appeals, issued an opinion in which they agreed with the government's argument and, in fact, did dismiss the case for lack of standing. And essentially what they said is that it isn't feasible for the courts to administer and enforce the remedy that the plaintiffs are asking for, and that they should take their grievances to the executive and legislative branches instead. So as you say, this was a very disappointing outcome. This is an important case that people have been watching closely. It's worth noting that the ruling was not unanimous. The Ninth Circuit is a 3-judge panel, and one of the judges did dissent with a very strongly worded opinion. And the case isn't over yet. I believe the plaintiffs are requesting review by a larger panel of the Ninth Circuit as a first step.
So we can follow this case through the Our Children's Trust website that has some wonderful materials and videos and instructive guidelines on the use of that. But there's also a lot of materials available on your website and following your work, which is also featured in the film Necessity, Oil, Water, and Climate Resistance that I've been involved with. Tell us more about, in closing, about how we follow these cases and the work of the Climate Defense Project.
Well, you can follow updates on our website, which is climatedefenseproject.org. There's also lots of great newsletters to sign up for and groups to follow, including Extinction Rebellion, 350.org. There's a lot of great climate action groups that are spread out across the country and have many local chapters as well.
How important is it for people to fill the courtrooms or to be outside during these cases to show support?
I would say it's important to get involved with some of the actions happening in your community. Courtroom support is helpful too. It's not always possible given the size of courtrooms and sort of, you know, the legal strategies, you know, whether we want people to pack the courtrooms or not, but often that is helpful. And certainly a lot of these campaigns doing civil disobedience need support from people in various ways throughout the process.
Well, thank you so much, Alice Cherry, for being with us this morning and for your important work with the Climate Defense Project, and we'll continue to follow you.
All right. Thank you very much, Jan.
Thanks, Jan and Alice Cherry. We will have links to the Climate Defense Project and the Children's Trust website, some of the other links that Alice Cherry referred to, and the film that Jan Hocken has produced on the necessity defense. Also want to remind listeners that they can go to smartcitypdx.com, where Hector Dominguez, one of our guests today, talked about the ways in which citizens can become involved in monitoring all of this surveillance technology and data that is often going into the wrong hands, and how we can mobilize to make sure that we create regulations and limits to that use of that technology. So smartcitypdx.com. And tomorrow there is a work session at Portland City Hall from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. about beginning discussions about how to limit that technology. And Bill Resnick, we want to thank him and Maria Cahill, Madeline Carroll, for their discussion of Oregon District Attorneys for the People, and encourage folks to check out their website as well as the Pacific Northwest Family Circle website with information on how we can elect more progressive district attorneys who are so critical in the criminal legal system. As always, you can subscribe to or listen to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KBOO website. And you can also find there links to past shows and segments with further links to even more useful information, including how to follow and contact us. The Old Mole Variety Hour will be back next Monday at 9 a.m.